Accession number 29954, reel 11.
Eric Saunders, reel 11. So, yes, Fairford.
So in Fairford, I was allocated to Theo Neumann, and then one day, simply one day, we were told, you're going tonight, you're going off tonight. And we went off at night to London. And we were in London for 6 weeks. During this 6 weeks, we were joined by Hladnik. I was allowed to live at home, which was wonderful. And I met Theo and Hladnik almost every weekday, doing and tried to learn Italian from Hugo's Teach Yourself Italian on the public transport. And we went to a little house off Kensington High Street, De Vere Gardens. I thought it was De Vere Gardens. I now know it actually belonged to the street at around the corner from De Vere Gardens, where a lady opened the door, and we went in. I was sat into the front room, was given a cup of tea and a wonderful service, China service, and those two went upstairs. In due course, a lorry arrived with an Austrian prisoner of war. He was taken upstairs, and Theo Neumann and Hans Hladnik interviewed him to get an idea of the situation in Austria at that time. They were obviously chosen for not at least being Nazis, but I wasn't part of it. But every time I saw the lady who opened the door for us, I had this feeling that I knew her. And I have mentioned this to you before. Well after this period, I suddenly remember that she was the lady who had given me my visa in London, in Vienna, and you actually confirmed that she was that lady. So it's a sad thing that I didn't recognize her. Now, she, of course, wouldn't recognize me, because she'd given it to hundreds and hundreds of people.
Mrs. Holmes,
yes. And I met her daughter once, and as you say, she was in Australia in school, so she must have been on her holidays, which fits to the period.
Canada, overseas.
And the girl brought me tea, but to my chagrin, she was a very good-looking girl, she didn't stay with me. Anyway, that's a fantastic coincidence, even more than the American soldier, that the woman who, against the rules, had given me a permit to immigrate to London was then actually one of the bosses of my SOE unit. Yeah?
I was going to ask, at what stage were the photographs taken where you were taken?
During those 6 weeks, we had 2 days where we had to report. I cannot remember where this was, but we were taken somewhere underground. I shouldn't be surprised if it wasn't part of Harrods underground little town, but I don't know. There was a big store there of clothing and all kinds of things. They took photos, they prepared the documents for me, both as a German Lance Corporal by the name of Erich Sandler, which was not far from my real name, and that of a French foreign worker by the name of Jean Martin. Martin was the surname of a girl I had known in Vienna when she came to visit from France. So it was, again, I felt I had to make sure somebody I would remember immediately. And I was given a wonderful leather coat, brilliant, new, shiny, wonderful metal, but all kinds of clothes were chosen for me but kept. Next time I saw those clothes, not all of them, I was also given a fighting knife, but I wasn't given it, a pistol, a 3.2 pistol. I was asked which I preferred a .32. The .45 was a bit too heavy for me, and the .22 doesn't do a harm to a bird. I mean, almost. And it was my favorite pistol from our training. I didn't want a Sten gun, and they didn't insist on anything else but a pistol and fighting knife. And so we were fitted out completely for action, and I was given and was allowed to keep a first aid kit which had a selected number of items, amongst them a newly discovered disinfectant, sulfanilamide. I had both sulfanilamide pills for an extreme infectious disease like pneumonia or something, and sulfanilamide powder for infectious wounds. I didn't know they were the same. They sounded the same, but I didn't know. And we were in London for almost 6 weeks. Maybe it was 4 weeks, maybe it was 5 weeks. In my mind, it's always been 6 weeks. Anyway, then again one night we had to report. We were taken in a lorry, which was closed up, to an airport near Oxford, where we were put into some sort of cargo plane. Because there were no seats in it, the floor was full of oilcloths or things like that, and we stretched out, and right at the back of the plane was somebody else already sleeping or lying there, whom we never weren't supposed to see and we never saw. And this was a Whitley bomber, the very same plane in which we had trained to be dropped, only the hole was covered up, luckily, the hole in the middle through which we had jumped during our training, parachute drop training. And we arrived in Algiers the next morning. Apparently we were the other person who was in, it could have been a girl, a woman for all I know, was kept in there until we had gone. There was a lorry waiting actually on the airfield outside the plane, and we got into the lorry. I sat in front next to the driver, whose name I do believe was Jim. And it was a long drive out of Algiers. We were only on the edge of Algiers. I don't quite know where exactly, but he pointed the steeples and the roofs and then pointed to one area and said, that's where the Casbah is. I'd seen a very famous film called Casbah with a French actor. And he said, we're not allowed to go in there. People get killed in there. And we travelled through the desert. I saw a dead camel and a bit of a dead horse. He said, oh, a few days ago the whole of the horse was still there. It's gradually been eaten up. And we saw some Bedouins walking along. It was altogether very romantic and strange and unusual, and the sun was burning down. And we came into this compound surrounded by barbed wire and a big barbed wire surrounded gate, and it was called Mati Fu, which was probably the name of the village. I didn't know whether it had any, it probably is an Arab word, but I knew that the Italians called you crazy Mati or Mato or Mazzo. So I wonder whether it was crazy, crazy. Fu is French for crazy. But I don't think that's true. It's probably an Arab word. And we were given a little tent in the desert sand, away from a kind of wooden building, large wooden building with a veranda outside. And we were given this tiny little built tent on the sand, not far from the sea, which was quite rocky there, funnily enough. The Mediterranean isn't supposed to be. Not only was the sea rocky, but huge rocks on along the side. Perhaps that's why they'd chosen this place. And we had two beds in there with mosquito nets, and it was mid-afternoon, it was still very hot. We had a rest, and then Theo suggested we went for a swim. No, it was early afternoon. That's important. We went for a swim, but of course we had no swimming swimsuits or anything, so we went in our underpants. Nobody have ever gone in your underpants into the sea, but they become totally transparent. And so we had a little swim along the edge, and when we were about to come out, go to our tent, between our tent and the sea, an officer with a couple of officers with their wives had set up a table and chairs and umbrella, sunshades and servants bringing them tea. And we had to somehow make our way back in transparent underpants, which were slipping down all the time. But we did what we had learned, crawled along the waterside of the rocks until we got to an angle and ran behind the office to our tent. Pack the underpants. I don't know whether you know this, but salt water doesn't allow water to dry. So these underpants were still as wet as they were then when we got to Italy.
So you and Theo Neumann were. Was it just a pair of you that left England together?
Yeah.
Just the two of you together?
That's true. Nobody knew when and that we had, unless they found we were gone the next morning.
And some had already gone. And
some had gone. Yeah, and in fact, we actually were still in Italy when we arrived there.
And what time was this? What date was this?
Well, I don't know whether you know your historical dates. It was after the invasion, after Salerno. Not long after Salerno, but some months after Salerno. I have all the dates. Again, I can look everything up, but I don't know it by heart. Let me see. 43, we joined. 44, Anderson Manor. This must have been around 45, and probably mid 40, probably summer 45. Have I got that right? Or 46?
You're probably a year out.
I was 46.
No, the other way.
Oh, the other way. It was 40. Yes, you're right. It was in Italy, 44, 45. You're quite right. It's 44. Sorry. Oh, I don't know what I'm saying. Sorry to the table leg. 44. Yes, it was 1944. That's quite right. And it was around September, October. I got to Italy around September, October.
So, and from how long did you stay in North Africa for? Not very long.
Well, we stayed in North Africa one night. And
right.
Jim had said he would see me in the morning. When he was taking us back early in the morning, 8 or 6 even, to the airport. But when the lorry came to fetch us, he wasn't there. And I sat next to another driver, and for a long time I didn't say anything because he wasn't as talkative as Jim. Jim had even shown me a picture of his family in London. And so I was quite sort of friendly with Jim. I think it's Jim or Tim, I'm not sure. And then I asked this bloke, I said, we were supposed to be taken by Jim. Jim was dead. He told me he had leave in the evening, he was going to town in the evening. He'd gone to town and must have followed a girl into the Casbah. And he was found in the morning, found in the night with a knife in his back. So I stopped talking altogether. This time we got into a larger plane, which had some other people in it. It was an Imperator or something like that plane, and we came down in Gibraltar, which was very exciting. It was above the rock. Have you ever been to Gibraltar? Well, it's quite amazing. As you approach it, you have this rather steep, pointed rock. And you fly around it, and there doesn't seem to be any place to land. There is actually a strip alongside the rock. And when we landed at one sea end, and it just stopped at the other sea end. It still does that. I've been there since, but much safer now. And as we got out of the plane, we had Theo reported with papers to some military office there for his next plane orders or something. And we had a few hours' time. And we first went to one side of that strip. That was the Spanish border. And there was a gate, an ordinary little gate. And with guards on each side. The British on one this side and the Spanish on the other side, and there were people coming out in back from Spain from work. And there were Spaniards going back into Spain from work in Gibraltar. It was very interesting to stand there and watch this for a while, and then they all showed up. But they've all known already, two of these people, so there's desultory. It's one of those words I'm never sure of. then we went to the opposite side, and there was the rock, and there was a huge opening, as wide as this house, at least. And we went in there. There was a huge round of fruit shops, and in England we hadn't had any fruit for years. I stuffed myself with grapes because they were easiest to eat, apples and such too heavy, and Theo warned me, he said I shouldn't eat so many. Of course I didn't wash them, but I was much too brave to be put off by Theo's warning. And at the back it went up into the rock, so out of curiosity I went up and found I came down on the other side. There was no way, if you wanted to go to rock you had to go off from the outside. Anyway, I didn't. Eventually we got into a plane. This was a troop carrier which was full of soldiers, probably coming back from leave or being stationed there, and had rows of seats on each side. It wasn't like an ordinary plane. And we came, as we approached Italy and went over the southern part of the Apennines, yes. Theo began to explain to me about the interesting landscape and plants and fauna. Is it fauna? Well, yeah, I prefer sauna, but it's fauna there. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and I said, I wish he'd stop talking, because all the other soldiers knew each other. They were from a company or something, or I don't know, they talked, chatted away. But here was Theo next to me, and he would see this interesting tree there. And I knew, another second, I'm going to be sick. In that moment, the plane landed. And your amazing thing was that the moment I stepped out of the plane, the whole of that sickness vanished within 2 or 3 seconds. So it was just the movement of the wind above the mountains. In Bari, we were met by somebody in a jeep. We were taken to our billets, this was Bari Airport. Our billets were just outside Bari. We met other friends who were already there, Georgie Brown, this lot, I was sent to a wireless operator lesson for refreshing, and there I was extremely lucky. It was an Italian who was teaching it, and after a few questions that I put to him, he said to me, "We had three stripes and a copper sanders, I think. They weren't real stripes. The army knew nothing about those. But we were entitled to wear them." Yes, Theo was a sergeant. I was his corporal. "Corporal Sanders, will you stay behind?" And this Italian said to me, "You know what your trouble is? You haven't got any idea of how electricity works. There is no point in you coming to my lessons until you have learnt it. Here are two books I recommend you to study them very carefully." And he was totally right. I had passed my radio exam in England by sheer fluke, because the instructor had put something wrong in each of the radio sets, which were suitcase sets, and we had put it right. And I unscrewed the back and I touched this and touched that, and I couldn't find anything. Didn't know what to do anyway. I knew to look for loose wires. That's all I knew. Screwed it together again, awaited my fate. And it worked. I've never found out how I repaired it. I think a wire was perhaps loose. and perhaps when you turned around it just touched its contact again. I have no idea. So I really didn't know anything. I'd never understood what that chap in England had told us. He took it for granted, which was true of most of the others, that we knew something about it. I had no idea what a fuse was, literally.
Can you just explain why this was so important, if you can remember why?
Because if something goes wrong with your set, you've got to be able to follow the circuit to find out what is wrong. You can sometimes replace something or leave something out. You could leave a resistance out, which would make perhaps a current a bit too strong in the next stage. But if you can't, if you don't understand what the circuit tells you, but I did within a week from those two books, which I kept for a long time, brought back to understand how electrons moved, what a resistance was I understood, and I began actually to enjoy looking up my circuit. It was of tremendous importance to me, and would have been even more had I been dropped. And we had regular schedules. Georgie Brown and I had a very funny misunderstanding. I sent him, we coded it, of course. I sent him a question, how do you like your new abode? And that was the only word he couldn't see. He said, we couldn't make out, is it abode or adobe? He didn't know the word, for all Georgie. He was very good in English, but that was a word he didn't happen not to know, and I happened to know. And that was all. I mean, we were there for a while, and then Theo and I were moved to near a Monopoly, away from Bari. In Bari, when I went into town, I made the acquaintance of a little Italian boy called Maurizio. He had a huge hole in his instep, and so I opened my medicaments, which I was not supposed to do it for action, but I felt certain they'd replace it, and put some sulfonamide, I'm not sure what that's the word, powder into it, and tried to tell him that he mustn't let any dirt coming in. But the way I spoke Italian was to think of the French word and Italianize it. And unfortunately, the word I used, sale, which is dirty in French, in Italian means salt. So he was very surprised that I told him not to put salt into his wound. And he wanted to become a tailor, Maurizio. But whenever I appeared in town, suddenly there was a Maurizio walking next to me. And he showed me the port where Mussolini had built a huge white wall. Huge. So the ships arriving saw something quite nice, a white big wall. But behind the wall was all rubbish and little broken down houses and so on. That was Mussolini's way of making things look better. And we were moved to this little fisherman's house on the Adriatic board. The back of the house was literally in line with the rocky shore. Deep, rocky shore. The Mediterranean. You could see Yugoslavia on the other side, or probably almost Albania. No, it was just about north of Albania where we were.
Montenegro.
Montenegro, yes, you're quite right. At the time, I didn't know. I just knew that this was Yugoslavia across there. The house was called Seaview. It had belonged to a fisherman. It was pretty rough. But we had a fairly big ground floor room where I set up my radio, two suitcase sets. We had a transformer outside so that in the evening we could, for a short time, we were allowed to have electric lights. I was still studying at the time, a correspondence course, trying to go on to a university degree in economics. So I had brought all my books with me, not that I did a lot of studying, but every little bit helped, and I had something to do when I had nothing to do, if you see what I mean. I bought candles and I put them next to my bed upstairs. There are quite a few rooms in that fisherman's house off this, and we've met O'Hara there, And whilst we were in London, I've forgotten to mention, but that is really important. Whilst we were in London, Theo explained the situation to me. He said that he and Hladnik were social democrats. He said that the SOE command had attempted to work with the right-wing party of Austria, who claimed to have contacts over there, and they tried them for almost for a year, but they couldn't deliver any kind of underground movements against Hitler. No contacts. They had one or two contacts with individuals, but nothing that the SOE could use. So reluctantly, they turned to the Social Democrats, one of whose leading members were a chap called Oskar Pollack, who had been the editor of the workers' paper in Vienna before the war. And there was this kind of social democratic cell in London, in which I was not, of which I was not a member. But I was taken to a meeting with Oskar Pollack, and Hans Hladnik was a civilian, really, or he was put on uniform. He never became a soldier. Couldn't have been. He was a very tall man with very broad shoulders. I think he had some lung problem. He was a social democratic peasant leader, one of the these rare things that almost don't exist. Peasant leaders in Austria tend not to be social democrats. But he was a Slovene, I think, originally. And so that's when I learned that I was part of a political setup. And that's why we were taken to Sibiu away from all the others. All the others were together in some other places. But later I went up on a ski school somewhere.
So other groups, for example, were more inclined to deal with action, sabotage, that sort of thing. But there was this political side to your mission, which other missions didn't have.
Yeah. Again, for instance, I'll give you an example. This whilst we were stationed, from there, we were stationed near Siena. Whilst we were stationed in Italy, at one time we went to meet Pietro Nenni. Now, it didn't mean much to me. Later, it turned out he was a very famous, well-known communist leader. And at this time, you know that the Italians had declared war on Germany, and Badoglio was now in charge. Mussolini had been killed, not right away, but eventually. And so the Italians were theoretically our allies now, although they treated us still very hostilely. No, they didn't, actually. I had quite a few Italian friends who were very pleased that we'd come. And when we get remembered,
Eric Saunders, Reel 12.
Baker's dozen.
Yes, just before we were talking about two things there. We were talking about the political side of your mission, but I also wanted to ask you about your dealings with local Italians where you were. I mean, again, I suppose you were kept deliberately away from them too, but you would have dealings with locals.
Well, funny thing occurred there. When we were at Sibiu, this fisherman's house, Hladnik, who felt a little less constrained, not being really in the army, I suppose, came to me one day and said, "Why don't you come with me?" He had found a woman in the village, or halfway between us and the village, to do our washing. I had wondered why he always was the one collected our things to be washed, and they always came back. He'd found a woman. And he said, she's got a daughter, a pretty daughter, Eric, and I had this reputation, which was only half deserved, honestly, but I did. And, I was younger, of course, than those two. Well, help me, I don't speak any Italian. So I went with him. And off the road, there was a kind of a shallow valley of grass, a grass-covered shallow valley, and a few yards away from the road, built into the rock that was covered by the grass, was a kind of little house, a room. has literally consisted of a square hole in the rock with a little division between, and a bed in there and a bed there and a table in the middle. And I met the woman, and her daughter was really pretty, but she was not the only daughter. There were two girls and two boys, and I'd never in my life seen such poverty. I mean, there was no furniture. I mean, there was this table. The light was a glass with olive oil and something swimming in it that was lit up. Another difficult thing was to speak Italian to them. They could understand my Italian very well, because it was good Italian as far as you can say that, because my vocabulary was very, very small. But it was correctly pronounced, probably with a foreign accent. But theirs was not. For instance, instead of "che stai facendo," what are you doing? In other words, how are you? They would say, saying "c'è sta pesce." Now, who would recognize what this means when you've learned to say "che stai facendo"? But I gradually learned it. They told me. And then I offered to give the girl English lessons. And that developed into something very strange, because she sent me little messages and our knees touched, and it was very tempting, because I really thought that time, I really thought this from time to time, I won't get out of this when I'm dropped. I'll never come back. And so the temptation to get engaged or even marry, I didn't think of that until Theo one day said, he said to me, "You know, she thinks you're going to marry her."